So welcome to Dev 304, Nailing Jelly to the Wall, how to get from vague requirements to a kick-ass test suite. I'm Ben Hughes. I'm a system analyst, and a system analyst at Equinox is sort of a combination of a business analyst and a test analyst, so we do sort of both ends. I have zero history in traditional BA work, which is really great because we are a really cutting-edge agile house, and it's fantastic.
And I'm Sean Tomlins. I'm a software developer at Equinox IT. My official title is development specialist. For all intents and purposes, I am a software developer, and I have been for the last 4 years.
Cool. So we're, as I said, from Equinox IT. We are both based down in Wellington, but there's also an Auckland office. So Equinox IT was established in 1995. It delivers software development, training, and consultancy work, and we inject fresh thinking to solve tough business problems. And that's our real goal, to find those really difficult things that hit every business and work through them and get them solved. So, as I said, I'm an analyst. So at the start of our process, we go through analysis. And our core outcome is that analysis is more than documentation. I think there's an unfortunate habit in traditional sort of BAs, and it's really sort of emphasized for them to document and redocument the requirements as they see them. So we end up just rewording and then reinterpreting what the problem is, and that doesn't really help it. It adds another layer of confusion. So as soon as you take some words and then put them into your own words and then put those into a document, you've already lost some of that core knowledge. It's gone. So the aim for analysis needs to be understanding and not documentation. If you can transfer knowledge and understanding as part of the analysis process, then you're really ahead of the game. That you're getting the best answer. And that's what we aim to do. So we go through a process that looks somewhat similar to this. So this is a modified diagram by Chris Hasser, who did a great talk on similar stuff. So how many people here work in sort of an agile company? Awesome. So these are terms that are hopefully reasonably familiar to you. So we start with an epic right up there. So an epic, if you're unaware, is just the really highest level requirement you can get. It's an idea. It's something they want to do. So we then go through and break that down into a number of user stories that allow us to think about each part of the system and how a user will interact through it. And then to tell whether or not the user story is correct, we develop acceptance criteria. So that fits there nicely. But then there's like this huge gap before we actually get to code. That traditionally is where the handover would occur. That's where you package up all your stuff and you kick it over the devs and you hope that you got your point across. So what can fit in there? And that's acceptance test-driven development. So if you're not a dev, this might seem a bit weird. So AT2D is not just a development practice. It's the entire application lifecycle. It's every part of it. It's ingrained, and it gives you the traceability throughout the entire thing.
All right, so what fits in between our acceptance criteria and our code, or the code that we're going to be writing, are these acceptance tests. And we're going to be collaborating with our clients to get that shared knowledge, shared understanding, and exemplify that in our acceptance tests. And once we have that nailed, then we can start writing some code. And the whole process of going from a user story to getting our acceptance criteria and then writing your acceptance tests, that's what we consider to be acceptance test driven development, that whole methodology. How many of you are familiar with acceptance test driven development, the name or the concept? Okay, a few there. How many of you are familiar with Dan North's version, behavior driven development? A few more. And what about specification by example? That's Gotchko, Edzik's flavor of it. Any Wow. Okay, couple. Okay, so altogether, these are the same thing. There are slight differences, but they cover so many of the same bases that we can consider them to be the same. And for the duration of this talk, we'll be talking about acceptance tests during development, or ATDD. And what's helpful to understand is where all this came from. So we had test-driven development. Who's heard of test-driven development? I'd hope you all know test-driven development. So that's a very simple concept. You create your test first, and that drives your implementation. So that's great for creating a bunch of production code that works well. But Dan North wasn't really satisfied with this, in that we were creating all this code, we were writing all these tests, but it wasn't necessarily delivering business value. So he came up with behavior-driven development, which is taking your agile requirements gathering and marrying that up to your test-driven development, or your your test suite. So by the end of it, you were able to create not only a software that works, but it's software that delivered business value and what the customer really cared about. Yeah.
So why did we settle on ATDD? So ATDD gives us a way to work together to define tests that validate the specification. So we work as part of sort of a combined team, so we have the analysts and the devs looking at this problem, but we also get the client in to help us go through this. Because the best way to, you know, actually ensure that you're meeting their problem and answering it is to get them to tell you how they want it to work, how they would test it. So it also provides a starting point for test automation, and that's something that we're going to really dive into throughout the rest of the talk. So ATDD, the way that you implement it, we use something called Gherkins, which are the cucumber thing?
Gherkins is the language, and cucumber was the original, one of the original tools.
And Ruby, right?
It was a Ruby thing, yeah.
Sweet. All right. So we use Gherkins, and they give you the sort of the test stubs, the very start that leads to your test automation framework. So let's run through it. Let's show you how this actually looks. So ATDD by example. So we start with something that is probably fairly familiar. So we have a very simple user story. So as a user, I want to write a blog so that I can tell my readers stuff. So that gives you a context. And we, as analysts, we put this directly into Visual Studio. And we keep it all with the rest of the stuff we're going to go through. So as developers see it, you always get that sort of knowledge of this is the thing that we're talking about. This is the realm of the application. So from that, we derive just a whole bunch of acceptance criteria. Just things that, you know, you might want to do if you're writing a blog post. So it's all, you know, drafting, publishing, unpublishing, editing, deleting, that kind of thing. And here's where it gets really interesting. So here is where we define our acceptance test. So this is an example of a Gherkin. So you can see that the language is structured almost similar to a user story. You have your given statements. So given I'm logged in as Frank and there are no blog posts. And that's your precondition. That's your entry into this test. Then you have your when step. So when I create a new blog post, and then we can actually put this stuff in here to, this is the data we'll be using to drive the test. And that ties back to the then. So the when is your action. What is the user doing in this test? And the then is simply the outcome, like what pops out at the end. And that's the data. So that's cool, but how does it actually work?
All right, so we use SpecFlow at Equinox ID. How many of you are using or have heard of SpecFlow? Okay, a few of you.
Awesome.
Okay, so SpecFlow at its core is a Gherkin parser. It takes our Gherkin scenario that we saw before, our given when then, and translate that into a test method. That's what it does, very simply. SpecFlow is a Visual Studio extension, and it comes as a NuGet package as well. So yeah, it's available if you've got a paid version of Visual Studio. If you don't, it's still available. It just has a bit of a rigmarole to get it working. So for this demo, I'm just going to walk through a very basic example of how you create your test from our Gherkins.
All right.
All right. So we've got our sample application. So it's our blog application from before. And it's got three projects within the solution. Our first project is going to be our very basic application. It's the MVC application. Let's just boot that up because we'll need it kind of loaded into memory for later. Once it gets going. All right, so you see it's nothing fancy. It's the worst blog in the world. You can create a new post and you can register. Okay, so that's what that project is. And now we've got another project, and that's going to be where our Gherkin scenario is going to be living. This is our acceptance test project. And by contrast, we've got this other project, which is our unit test project. So I'm sure all of you have done some kind of unit test program before. And so this should be very familiar with you. But just so you understand where SpecFlow is going with this, we'll open up this and kind of see what you'd do normally. So we've got our test class with our test class attribute and our test method with a test method attribute. And you'll be able to put that through your test runner and they'll execute and run fine. And you probably write some code, some test code inside this test method, and you'll probably follow this paradigm of arrange, act, assert. And that's great, that's what we're used to. But what SpecFlow does, it takes that Gherkin and turns it into this with just a bit more on top. So if we go into our acceptance test, we can see the exact same structure. So let's pop open our feature. Okay, so this is our acceptance test that we had up in our previous slides. You can notice that it's got syntax highlighting, so that's pretty cool. It comes out of the box. The fact that it's purple means that we haven't defined what each of these steps are going to be. And all of this code gets parsed and put into a code behind. So if we look behind our feature file, we've got our same structure as before. We've got a test class with our test class attribute. And down the bottom we have our, here it is. We've got our scenario, which is just the title of the scenario. And we've got our test method attribute. So we're going to be able to execute that through our test runner. What SpecFlow has also done is taken each one of those steps and insert that in place of where you would put your arrange, act, assert. So instead of arrange, we have given steps. Instead of when, we have our when steps. And then, of course, we have our assert. Okay. So that's great. That's pretty cool. So we can now go right-click and run our SpecFlow scenarios. Yeah, sure. All right, and we see that it's failed. That's good. Failing tests are good. So we've got a running test. It doesn't pass, but that doesn't really matter at this stage. But what SpecFlow has done for us, it said that, okay, we're missing a step definition. You haven't defined what you're going to do at this given step. And that's where it's gone that extra little bit and said, hey, just take this bit of code, dump it into a class file somewhere, and you're going to be able to start writing some kind of test code against that. It even goes as far as to give you the whole class of all the missing step definitions. So it gives you this class here with all the missing steps. You're going to be able to take that, copy it into a file somewhere, and then you're kind of away flying. All right, so it's purple now. I'm missing my steps, so I'm going to go into a file that I created earlier. I just commented out. Save that. All right, you'll notice that's gone black because SpecFlow can now identify that I found a step for given I'm logged in as Frank. So that's cool. But what's kind of interesting here is that it's kind of italicized and grayed out the word Frank. And that's because you can pass some parameters through your steps using regular expressions. So it's going to find each of your step definitions by regular expressions, and it allows you to parameterize those. So if we go into this, go to the definition of this step. Okay. something really basic. It's a really bad test, but it gets the point across. So it's looking for these given attributes and some kind of string to match their regular expression. So given I'm logged in as someone. So what's cool about this is that I can then start reusing this step. This step here, I can go in and change to whatever name I want it. And it's kind of done the, not the refactoring, but the reusability of my test code for me. So yeah, that's a pretty cool feature if you're ever doing tests and you run into a lot of reused code. That's pretty handy to have. All right, so now we've got some step definitions, and they do something. It doesn't really matter what they do. Run our scenarios again. And hey, it's passing. Great, that's cool. Another cool thing about SpecFlow, though, is that it's told me what happened in each step. So it's going to give you some feedback as to whether a step passes or fails. So this is great for debugging if you're ever some like long test code. This is really handy because it's kind of chopped it up and you're able to debug much faster. The other cool thing is that it told me how long each one of these steps took. So you notice here that this second step, that's taking 2.2 seconds. So kind of it's a really slow step if you're used to doing unit tests. So that's great because then I can go in and identify, okay, this step here, there are no blog posts, this is taking a long time, go in and have a look. You can see that it's doing something against a repository somewhere, so it's kind of integration level stuff. Yeah. So that's very much the basics of SpecFlow. What you may notice here though is that I've decorated this with what they call tags. So I can decorate this scenario with whatever I want. At Equinox, we use this as our method of traceability. So if I create a scenario and it's against a TFS item, it just allows me to track that, and it's kind of it's whereabouts it is inside of our test suite. And yeah, that's SpecFlow.
So we did that, and it mostly worked. So this was sort of a process we went through a few years ago. We found SpecFlow, and we found this way to do all this test automation, and it looked great, and it still is really great, but it still also fails on a couple of points.
All right. So the journey that we went on when we started writing our acceptance test is that we had all of our tests were manual regression tests. So we're doing that at the end of our lifecycle. And that was bad. So we decided, okay, we're going to write them all as acceptance tests. And the way that we did that was that we took our manual regression test suite and we automated them through the UI, making UI tests. Now, this is good. It helped us in that it gave us more frequent feedback. We didn't have to wait days and weeks in order to get feedback from our manual regression testers. We got it more frequently, so we got it in orders of hours instead of days and weeks. Of course, we were taking away work from the testers, but that's fine. They can go off and test other things. So it was good. We kind of lightened the load. And because we're getting that constant feedback, we caught bugs faster. So if you're a developer, that's great, because then you have the confidence to change something and you don't worry about breaking all your production code. But we still had problems. We still didn't like where we were at. We identified that our UI tests were hurting us. They were hard and they were slow. And one of the reasons, one of the kind of exacerbating factors of that was that we structured them like we did our manual tests. So a lot of features were crossed over. So we would go through the process of logging in and doing this feature and clicking on this. And we had really long test paths. And if you have long test paths, that means that the probability that something's going to break along that test path is much higher. So we had kind of brittle tests on top of the fact that they were automated through the UI. And also, it kind of sucked for debugging because we would break something on maybe step two, and then step 15, we get to the end and say, oh, your test hasn't worked. Why? Well, you're going to go fishing and find out where this bug is. And the feedback was far too slow. We still had it in the order of hours, and we wanted to have it much faster. We wanted to know when we were breaking something that mattered to our system. Because they were structured like our manual tests, they also had the effect of not really showing what we were testing. We were talking about click this, put enter this value into this part of the screen, go onto the next screen, this really long workflow, and it was difficult to understand what exactly we were testing. So we had all this acceptance criteria being tested by a one like monolithic test. So the readability of our test was just horrible. And our last failure was that we were writing our test after we had already written our production code. So this was our way of alleviating the fact that UI tests are hard to write, and you kind of need to write something before you actually write your test sometimes. But we got into this bad habit of writing our tests after the fact. So we weren't driving our development from our tests, which is kind of goes against the whole idea of test-driven development. So this might look semi-familiar. So this is where we're trending toward. We had a large proportion of UI tests. We did have unit tests. We had a lot of unit tests. They weren't necessarily testing things that the user cared about. They were testing our implementation. So, of course, what I said before, we identified that UI tests are hard. They're hard to maintain, hard to build, and that they run slowly. So we accepted that we didn't have to automate everything through the UI. We didn't want to, really. So this is Mike Cohen's testing pyramid. Has everyone seen this? How many of you are familiar with this? Okay, a few. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so Mike Cohen talks about these three levels. So there's the UI level, the service level, and the unit testing level. So his idea was that if you write more unit tests and more of these what he calls service tests, you get away with not having to write so many UI tests. And that's kind of where we wanted to be. The service level, it's not talking about anything like web services or any kind of architecture, like service-oriented architecture. It's talking about something that the code provides to the user, either directly or indirectly. But it doesn't necessarily have to be through the UI, so it's separated out.
Yeah. Cool. So we've spoken a lot about... spoken a lot about automating our tests. It's important to say that we're not replacing manual testing entirely. We just want to make manual testing the most beneficial and valuable it can be. And the way that is to get a really strong core automated test suite and then sort of be able to float exploratory testing around the top. So there's a lot of tooling to try and make your exploratory testing much more valuable. There's a couple of Microsoft tools, the Test Manager and things like that are really good for this, allow you to record your steps as you're going, make sure your tests are good. So this is where exploratory testing needs to fit. So how do we do acceptance testing for that service layer? Fuck, I said layer. the service region, the things that you're testing there. So once we did that, we found that they took overall about as much effort to implement. So the sort of end-to-end time was pretty similar. So this might seem like a negative. They are much easier to actually implement than UI tests. UI tests can be very dense, and as Sean was saying, can be quite brittle and unreliable. Whereas if you have a really nicely scoped service test, then it works. It's much easier to get done. It's much faster to run, so our suite would run in minutes rather than hours. And that's great. It gives you that really quick feedback to let you know that your thing is working. And the tests were much easier to understand because instead of trying to test absolutely everything, they tested just the one thing and made sure that thing worked. So let's look at how this is done. Let's run through a scenario that really dives deep into how we figured out our test suite. So once again, we'll start with the problem. We'll start with a user story. So as a user, I want to register so that I can comment on blog posts. We find a couple of requirements. I need to supply a username. I need to supply a secure password. And I need to supply a valid email address. So these kinds of terms, you know, secure and valid, they mean a lot of things to different people. And this A2D is a way of really honing in on that and make sure that you're testing the right things. So let's start with an example of how we were doing it. So again, Gherkin context, so scenario outline, user can register. We set up our given steps. So the user has entered username as their username. So it's just really, you know, we can put values in and use that to run the test. And they have entered password as their password, and they have entered email as their email address. So that sets up your test. That makes sure that you're hitting that username, password, email thing. That's great. So when the user clicks the register button, then the message something displays. So you can see we've been using these braced terms. And the way you fill these out is examples. This is something that we use extensively because it's really cool. So set this up, username, password, email, and then the message for the display. So obviously, if they supply nothing at all, you get a failure. If they supply this combination, so a username looks vaguely right, the password looks vaguely right, and the email is vaguely right, then they get a success. If they supply this combination, it's a failure, because I don't know, maybe that email address is a little hinky. And if they do this way, it's also a failure. And who knows why? Maybe it's the username, maybe it's the password. And you can see that this can just sort of go on forever. Like, because you're effectively testing three things at once. Oh, four, because you're doing the click. You've already put in the UI context, so it's enforced that that's the way that the test has to be written. So this is wrong. This leads to these really dense, horrifying tests that just sort of do absolutely everything. So to fix that, we break it out. So for our registration example, we'll start with just our validation of registration. And that looks like this. So you can see there that the layout is fairly similar to that UI test. We're still looking at username, password, email together. Because in order for that registration to succeed, you need to supply these guys. But instead of using concrete values, we can just use valid or invalid, because for this test, that's all that matters. So we can just, again, fill out our examples with things like this. Three valid, you'll get a success. Three invalid, you'll get a failure. And then various combinations, you'll get failures as well. So you can fill this out to its full complement of eight tests, and that gives you that really clear matrix of what's going to work, what things need to be there for the test to succeed. So that's cool. That's a good start. That means we're only testing that registration and whether or not it can even pass. So what's next? We mentioned the username, password, and email being valid or invalid. So we need to now write those tests too. So we have this other one. We have this one that's just looking at the username and saying whether or not it's valid or invalid. And here we do want to be using concrete examples. So blank, invalid. Username, perfectly fine, valid. And the way that we determine whether or not they're valid or invalid are those conversations, the chats you have with the client, because they can tell you which one should be allowed, and you can put those directly into your tests. So you can keep exploring. And this way you are only testing, again, just the username. And then that can feed into your other tests. So we do the same for password. So password is an interesting one because there's so many combinations that might or might not work. But again, that's a conversation you have. So you have your test data. All that, yeah. Turns out that they wanted at least eight characters and they wanted a combination of upper and lowercase. Cool. So we've got that, that's our valid test. And then we can do our email validation as well. So again, we run through, we have that conversation, we find out what values are valid, and we get those in the test. So that gives us this. So we've got our three tests that just do quick validation. We do our slightly larger test that looks at the combinations and whether or not they'll succeed. But then we need something up the top. We need a UI test, something to test that, yes, all these individual parts are working, and then you want one that can actually look at the UI and make sure that that's working as well. So this layout hopefully looks a little bit familiar, like this. Where it actually fits is about here. So we mentioned service, and this is sort of what we're talking about. It's that simple validation. It's checking whether or not registration is able to go ahead. It's not doing the big tests. It's just looking at little combination tests, little things that, that work together. So now that we know we need a UI test, let's write that up. So again, very, very similar to the original UI test. And indeed, it also has quite similar examples. But this is where it can stop. We don't need that huge combination. We don't need to be testing every potential email or username because you've got those tests separately and they're covering that. Here, you just want to give them a nice, you know, tick all the boxes example and cross all the boxes example. Just get a success and a failure going and then have that be your UI test. So I just wrote a whole bunch of stuff and gave Sean a whole bunch of work. So how does that play? How does that actually translate to code?
All right. So this demo, I'm just going to show you how I would go about implementing those tests. So cracking open our acceptance test project from before, we've got in here another feature file. I probably should have mentioned this earlier. These feature files are spec flow specific. They're a new file type, and you can kind of tell them apart by their cute little cucumber icon. And we've got our registration feature here. I've just copy and pasted what Ben's done earlier. Okay, so let me just speak to the way that these scenarios are structured. So before we had when I click this button. So that's very imperative. That speaks to an implementation-specific thing. And we want to get away from that. By making our tests a bit more declarative, we kind of give ourselves a bit of wiggle room. So this test, which I've earmarked to be a UI test, I could easily have taken that step and put it into a service level test. So it kind of reinforces the idea of talking in a, kind of a ubiquitous language, whether you're talking about something on the UI or talking at something a bit more low level. Okay, so again with the tags. So we've got our tag here that signifies, okay, this test I'm going to be running as a UI test. And the rest of them, they're going to be these service level tests. And I know that my UI test is going to be a long running process, so I want to be able to run those separately from my other tests. And the cool thing about SpecFlow is that it leverages the testing frameworks that you put under it. You can use MSTest, you can also use NUnit. I think you can use XUnit with a few configuration things. But yeah, it's leveraging the testing frameworks already put in place. So if we go into the file behind our feature file and find our registration flow scenario, where is it? There it is. We can see that SpecFlow has decorated this test method with a test category UI. So if any of you are using the test categories currently, you'll know that you're able to then group your tests via these test category attributes. So if I go back to my test runner and change it to categories, I can, no, not yet. Give me a second. Oh, there had to be one. All right, so that's just the UI test kicking off. All right, going back to my test session. I can see that I've got this category here of UI. So I can then separate out my UI tests from my service level tests. I don't necessarily have to stick all my long-running tests into a different assembly. I can keep them here and just leave the effort of separating them out for our testing purposes later to maybe my continuous integration suite. So this is kind of a handy way to do that. Maybe you would want to separate out your UI test into another project. It's completely up to you, this kind of stuff. But it gives you a bit of flexibility as far as grouping them and being able to execute them when you want to. Okay, so that's just the final thing I want to say about the tag. So now we want to implement these tests. And the way that I would go about it would be to pick off the low-hanging fruit. So looking at these tests, we know that this one's probably going to be dependent. This UI test is going to probably be dependent on the other test. So I'm going to attack one of these lower ones, this user validation one first. Okay. I've already written the code for this. And let's go have a look at the definition of this test. All right. So here are our steps. I'll give them when then. And it's very simple. It's taking a parameter, putting it into some object. What makes sense probably is a registration model. Then my when step is going to execute some bit of code that's going to validate that registration model. So I create something called a username validator, and I make that run its thing over registration model. It gives me a result. That's cool. And in my final step, I assert that result. So that's very simple. But what's cool about this is that I've now written my test code for all those different examples. I don't have to go and edit those. If I want to add a new example, this is basically my data set. So I can then have Ben come up with another requirement saying, oh, we need to cater for this other thing that's going to change the username. So I just would then add another line. And then that would create a new failing test. And so we'd go through that whole regreen factor. I'd have a failing test that I could then go into my production code, edit that, and get that passing, and it's great.
Yeah, so that gives us a really powerful tool as an analyst. We can go and as things change, and they're always going to change. So it might just be there's another example that we really need to cater for in our test, or it could be that what is actually a valid username or password or what have you has completely changed. And I can just go in and change these examples here. I can put the new requirements almost straight into there. And the test code doesn't have to change. It'll just run, and it'll run those new examples, and it will expect the valid or invalid that I've put in there. And that allows, that'll you know, obviously fail because it's a complete change. But then it can just, then the focus just becomes developing the system to ensure that they do pass, rather than having to also go and redo your test stuff. It'll work.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so that's our username validation acceptance test. And we go and do the same thing for these other ones because they're very similar. Okay, so let's go focus on this registration validation one. So I can see here that I'm taking in some kind of input into my username, my password, and my email. But I'm getting this abstract value, which is a valid or invalid. And because these validators are going to be executing after I run the registration validation, I'm either going to have to do two things. I'm going to either have to create behind the scenes a value that I, as the developer, think is a valid or invalid password and use that as my test data. Or I can use mocking. So I could then kind of force this username validator to give me a valid or invalid result. Which is fine because we're not testing whether they can validate a username or a password or anything like that. We just want to know that the combination together gives us what we expect for the registration. Okay, so let's go into the step definition for one of these, well, for all of these actually. So as you can see here, I took the path of mocking up my validators and that's fine, but that's not the interesting part. What's the interesting part about this is this thing at the top. I was able to decorate the same bit of code, same bit of test code, and reuse that and just put on different attributes. They all have the same signature, basically, and they all effectively will do the same thing because I'm doing the mocking thing. So yeah, that's another way that it gives you a bit of flexibility if you are a developer and you are writing tests. I'll finish with that one. Yeah, and then we'll go into this registration flow one. So I'm going to, because it's a web application, I'm going to be using an automation tool called Selenium. How many of you have heard of Selenium? Oh, okay, a lot of web developers in the house. Okay, so yeah, I'm going to write my tests in Selenium, and it's going to put real-world values in because we have to put real-world values into our UI. It's only going to execute these two tests. You saw that running before. You saw that it opens up the registration page. It executes the registration with a failing and a success path, and that's all it does. So this final test, this UI test, does a few things for us. It allows us to test that the UI does what it needs to do. Although brittle, it still does that. But it's a very thin slice through your system, so it's not going through through that deviation to, okay, what's the valid username. It's all taken care of those kind of lower level tests. So that's kind of what you want. Why else would we need them? Because you might be doing something interesting, like you might be doing some kind of inversion of control or dependency injection. And for that, you'll probably have to set up some kind of IOC container and do some kind of configuration. And the configuration that you do for that might be different slightly if you're doing it in your test environment and in your production environment. So it's a good way of smoke testing anything like that. All right, so that's all of our acceptance tests done. And that kind of leaves us still a bit of a gap to get to a kick-ass test suite. So from there, you're going to have to start using your tooling. So you're going to have to rely on metrics, and you're going to have to rely on test coverage. So test coverage is going to allow you to find the gaps inside your code, inside the implementation that you created in your production code, and then make sure that that's sound. So unit tests to us become more of an implementation-specific thing. They're testing the nuts and bolts of our production code. That's cool. And you're going to have to rely on your metrics to give you some indication of how solid and how dry your code is. So that kind of quality stuff, rely on your metrics for that. ATDD doesn't cover that. It kind of stops at this point. And then your other coding practices come in. And probably the final thing I'll say about these tests is that you want to manually test each one of them. You still have to do manual testing of them just to make sure that they're not giving you false positives. All right, that's it.
Cool. So you can sort of see why the end-to-end effort is about the same. So where we just had one gigantic UI test, we end up splitting that out and dispersing it and ensuring that each test is just hitting an individual thing. It'll still take about the same time, but because you get those really focused tests, your suite's much stronger for it. And as I said, you can go in and add more examples. So that's where we are now. But there's still room for improvement. There's still things that we're experimenting with. In this industry, you always want to be trying new things and seeing where you can get to. This is one that I am excited to try. I have no idea if it will work. This is just sort of an isolated UI test. So UI tests are brittle for the reason they have to do so much setting up and going through. And you have to, inject the values in so it'll work nicely. And that's a pain because, as I said, if the requirements change, then that doesn't support that. So maybe we could just do this. Maybe we could just have a pass or failed for the entire validation and then just test that the message pops up.
And just mock out the implementation, right?
Yeah, so just mock everything, it'll be fine. So this is sort of our next step. So in conclusion, we went for ATDD because it answered a lot of questions for us. But the primary answer it provided was that tests need to validate the requirements as well as the code. If you're just testing your code, it's almost too late. It's already gone. If you can work with the client and write those tests, so those gherkins we use for our actual requirement validation. We use those as our conversation pieces. We get agreement at that point. And that's testing the requirement even before there's any code to be seen. We also see that there's a strong correlation between the design of the acceptance tests and the ease of the test automation. So where previously we had a test that looked really good to us, like it did everything. It had all of your inputs and all of your outputs, and that was great as a tester. But when it hit automation, it was the worst thing in the world because it's so hard to deal with. And that's something we need to move away from, and that's why we've gone for the approach that we have. I mentioned at the start of the talk that this is called how to nail jelly to the wall. So if you actually wanted to know how to nail literal jelly to a literal wall, I have two answers for you. You can full-blown cheat and just leave it in the box and nail that to the wall. That satisfies the requirement, but isn't really what you wanted. You can also make it double consistency and then nail it, and this will definitely work. You have this sort of really thick blob of jelly nailed. So, success. If you want just pure normal jelly, you are out of luck. So, thanks for coming along. Related content, teaching good developers to be bad people, I think that's Friday morning-ish, and it looks like it should be a really fun talk. There's a hands-off lab just talking about team development using Visual Studio Online. So we do a lot of ALM work at Equinox IT, and so this is of interest to us. And you can find us later wandering around. Sean's reasonably tall, so you find him, and I'm reasonably hairy, so you can find me quite quickly, easily. Check out these resources and ensure that you complete your session evaluation because there are prizes scattered throughout the day. So thank you.
Thanks.